And let's go now from center court to center ice. The National Hockey League is trying to keep the Phoenix Coyotes from moving to Canada. Our commentator Frank DeFord says the NHL needs to let go.
Long ago, one evening in 1966, I was in a suite at the Royal York Hotel in Toronto with some folks from the National Hockey League. They were all feeling pretty heady. The league was about to double in size, an incursion into the United States that would take Canada's game as far south as Los Angeles. Since the NHL was a huge success in all its six franchise cities in Canada and the northern U.S., everybody was certain that great times must lie ahead in the expansion outpost. Also, optimism was fueled by a bottle of good Canadian whiskey. When the last drop was consumed, someone tossed it onto the floor. "Dead soldier," he said. An old coach pointed at the empty bottle and laughed. "That'll be the National Basketball Association after we start next year." Of course, it didn't work out quite that way. Within a few years, Jack Kent Cook, the owner of the Los Angeles franchise, would moan, "They told me there were 300,000 Canadians who'd moved to Southern California. How was I to know that they were the 300,000 Canadians who didn't like hockey?" What the NHL found out is that it's hard to export a sport to where most residents are unfamiliar with the game. But the league is pressed on, forever sprinkling franchises into places like Miami and Nashville and Raleigh in a vain effort to be a fully national American television sport. It doesn't seem to do any good. NHL ratings are traditionally woeful, especially down south. The Phoenix Coyotes, largely unnoticed by the inhabitants of Arizona, have now gone bankrupt. A wealthy Canadian wants to pay almost $250 million to buy a franchise that is worthless in the desert and move it to Hamilton, Ontario, where it would be positively adored. But the NHL is fighting in bankruptcy court to hold on to the Coyotes. What a shame. Look, it's no insult for a sport not to be appreciated everywhere. Pride and television are no match for love and cheers, and hockey is too good a game to be held up to ridicule just because its vainglorious patrons' reach exceeds their grasp. The NHL should render unto Canada what is Canada's and let the Coyotes go to where they are wanted.
Commentator Frank DeFord renders unto us each week from Ember Station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. For many of the leaders gathered at the UN in New York this week, their next stop is Pittsburgh. The G20 meets there on Thursday and Friday. The G20 consists of the big industrial countries plus the biggest developing countries. The group previously met under crisis circumstances last December. It was trying to fashion an emergency response to the global financial downturn. Now, as NPR's John Itzde reports, this week's focus is ensuring long-term stability.
At the top of the Pittsburgh summit agenda is an attempt to correct the mistakes that led to the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Among them, a failure of regulation. Most of the headlines in the run-up to the meeting have involved plans to rein in the huge salaries and bonuses paid to bankers and traders. It's a cause that resonates in every country, says Ted Truman of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Every political leader and many business leaders, for that matter, have declared themselves as outraged, and it plays well in the political process.
France's President Sarkozy has proposed capping compensation for bankers. Dan Prince, who was President Bush's chief aide at the first G20 summit last December, says Sarkozy's proposal is a distraction.
Fortunately, President Obama and his advisors are on record opposing that, and rightly so. So, as I say, the final risk is that there is the possibility, as you run up to these things, that something kind of hijacks the attention and becomes a distraction from the important work of reform.
The leaders will likely endorse a set of compensation guidelines without caps. They'll also likely address the issue of requiring banks to hold more capital. But for the Obama administration, the most important work of reform is addressing global imbalances that American officials believe set the stage for the crisis. For instance, in the years before the financial meltdown, countries like the U.S. and Britain consumed too much and saved too little, while big export machines like China and Germany saved too much and didn't consume enough. Their huge saving surpluses helped create a huge pool of cheap money that led investors to take too much risk. The U.S. wants the G20 countries to agree to get their savings and consumption in closer balance. Nick Lardy of the Peterson Institute says for countries like China and Germany, that would mean increasing their consumption and relying less on exports for growth. For the U.S., he says, it's basically the opposite.
That we are going to be saving more, that the United States consumer is not going to be the global consumer of last resort.
Many of the G20's nations, including China, agree this rebalancing is a good idea in principle. But the Chinese are leery of signing up to meet specific targets, says Lardy.
They've adopted a lot of policies that will help move them in that direction, but I don't think they really have the confidence yet that they'll be able to sustain that. So they're very reluctant to sign up for an international agreement that would constrain them and might cause them to have to adopt policies that would lead to much slower growth.
Ted Truman, a former Treasury official who helped the Obama administration prepare for the last G20 summit, says that likely means no targets. Instead, he sees a role for the IMF keeping track of how the countries are doing, and then at future G20 meetings, he sees the leaders reviewing their own progress.
Discussing among themselves, well, we wrote this in September of 2009, and to what extent are we, either individually or collectively, living up to our commitments?
A global framework that eliminates economic imbalances might create more stable global growth. But history suggests the odds of implementation are low. Similar frameworks have been tried several times before in the past 25 years with little success. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.
The current Congress is considering bills that would help provide health insurance to millions of Americans who don't have it. If this comes about, one of the big beneficiaries would be Hispanics. A third of all Hispanics in the U.S. are uninsured. Dr. Elena Rios is president of the National Hispanic Medical Association. She says there are cultural reasons as well as economic ones.
Hispanics have health beliefs that are unique, lots of traditional ways of taking care of disease with teas and herbs and other things. And so families don't send their children or young adults to doctors. Another reason is other Hispanics come from other countries where their government provides health insurance.
So they don't expect to have to pay for it themselves.
Right. And there's also the trust factors. Hispanics tend not to trust these authority figures, and let alone government, because we have mixed families with undocumented grandparents who don't want to be deported back to where they come from.
What then do you think would be the change that would be most important for this population?
I think access to health care services by having affordable health insurance. Of course, there would have to be lots of education and outreach of the importance of purchasing health insurance.
Sort of just get them on the insurance rolls. That would make a big difference.
Well, it's not only getting them on the insurance rolls. It's also we need the Hispanics to become the doctors and nurses in the clinics and in the hospitals in the communities that are going to have an increased demand.
One of the questions that was raised in some of those fairly obstreperous town meetings that were held over the summer about health care reform was about coverage of illegal immigrants. Now the president says it's not happening. Do you think it should? Is leaving them out going to cause some kind of consequence that we need to take note of?
Well, I think the consequence of leaving them out is that there will be more sickness carried by persons who are in our restaurants, who work in our hotels, who work in our communities, that can impact every American citizen.
Does your organization take a position on insuring illegal immigrants?
No, our organization agrees with President Obama to have this health care reform system be changed for American citizens and those eligible to participate for health reform, and that does not include illegal and undocumented.
What about people who are in this country legally? Not citizens, but here legally, working legally, Should they be covered?
Yes, and in order to increase access to as many eligible people as possible in our communities, especially with Hispanic undocumented who have become legal, we feel that they should have access on day one as everyone else would.
Dr. Rios, this, and I know this has been a huge concern of yours, that there are so many people that don't have access to health care in the Hispanic community in the United States. Do you think that the kinds of health care plans that Congress is looking at will settle that?
Well, I think that it's a first step in allowing an affordable health insurance system to be created. You know, 25% of the country is about to become Hispanic. We only have 5% Hispanic doctors, 2% Hispanic nurses. So to have cultural competence training targeted to populations like the Hispanic family and the Hispanic community is a very big success story yet to be seen.
Dr. Rios, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Dr. Elena Rios is president of the National Hispanic Medical Association.
The president's speech followed a special meeting at the United Nations on climate change that produced strong rhetoric but no breakthroughs. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called this meeting in advance of a December deadline. That's when talks in Copenhagen are supposed to produce a new treaty to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases around the world. From New York, NPR's Richard Harris reports on the prospects for an agreement before year's end.
About 100 world leaders attended the meeting in New York, and 8 of them had a chance to address the General Assembly. Sweden's Prime Minister, Fredrik Reinfeldt, bluntly stated the central dilemma.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are only 76 days from the Copenhagen meeting, but the negotiations are going far too slow, and they are still lacking real progress. We are close to a deadlock. As leaders, we now have a job to do.
That job, he said, is to flex their political muscles and give clear direction to the diplomats who are stuck trying to resolve hundreds of contentious issues. For example, the nations can't agree about how much to cut their emissions, and they can't agree about how to provide funds for the developing world to help poor countries adapt to a changing planet. And nothing from the morning speeches suggested that the world leaders are finding a way out of that morass. President Obama said his administration has set up numerous international meetings and taken serious steps at home to start the nation down the path toward lower emissions.
We understand the gravity of the climate threat. We are determined to act, and we will meet our responsibility to future generations.
But the president didn't spell out what shape that would take in the international climate talks. The administration is constrained by the U.S. Senate, which must cast at least 67 votes in favor of a treaty to ratify it. But the Senate hasn't settled on domestic climate legislation, let alone the ground rules for an international agreement. China's president, Hu Jintao, also spoke of his nation's ambitious domestic plans. China is now the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases. China plans to slow the pace of emissions growth, but that's not at all the same as actually reducing emissions overall. Speaking through an interpreter, Hu said China also plans to grow more forests to soak up carbon dioxide.
Dear colleagues, out of a sense of responsibility to its own people and people across the world, China has taken and will continue to take determined and practical steps to tackle this challenge.
Hu did not suggest a way out of the climate talk deadlock. Even so, his comments drew kudos from French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Sarkozy also complimented the new government of Japan for adopting a tough new emissions reductions target. But on the whole, Sarkozy's tone was angry, and that was evident even through an interpreter's voice. He called for a new meeting of the countries that contribute most to climate change.
To transcend the role-playing, the empty speeches, the petty diplomatic games, and to table concrete proposals.
And for an emotional appeal, President Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives reminded the assembled leaders what's at stake. His island republic is barely above sea level today. Global warming could soon raise the oceans and flood the Maldives out of existence. Nasheed said he's often called upon to remind people in the rich countries about the fate of small island states, but he says the world continues on, business as usual.
We in the Maldives desperately want to believe that one day our words will have an effect. And so we continue to shout them, even though deep down we know that You're not really listening.
Time's running out, he said.
We cannot make Copenhagen a pact for suicide. We have to succeed and we have to make a deal in Copenhagen. Thank you very much.
Negotiators have two more preparatory sessions before the Copenhagen talks open in December. And some of that time will no doubt be spent figuring out how to make sure the climate talks don't collapse entirely. Richard Harris, NPR News, New York.
This week's parlor game in Washington is a version of an old favorite. Who leaked a confidential report to a newspaper and why? NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore has been thinking about the answer to the latest version of that question.
The latter-day deep throat who furnished the Washington Post's Bob Woodward with a copy of General Stanley McChrystal's devastating report on the growing threat in Afghanistan clearly wanted to force President Obama's hand. Because of security concerns, Woodward agreed to delay publication for a day and then to excise sensitive passages. It was clearly a cooperative venture. The bearers of security secrets, and those with an interest in spilling them. I was reminded of a famous episode in 1975 when CIA Director William Colby called at my CBS office to request that I delay airing a story about an effort to raise a Soviet nuclear submarine from the ocean floor. I was released from my commitment when somebody else broke the story. Whoever leaked the McChrystal report was clearly hoping to create pressure for reinforcements. The 66-page document, with its many warnings that the Afghan war was headed towards failure, had been drifting upward through channels for 3 weeks. On television, the president made a virtue of the delay, saying that he would make no decision until he had absolute clarity about the course to pursue. But the McChrystal report puts heavy emphasis on the time factor. Its conclusion is that without reinforcements, within a year, defeating the Taliban insurgency would no longer be possible. The president has support from civilian leaders like Carl Levin, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, for rethinking the Afghan strategy before committing further troops. But indications are that General McChrystal has substantial support from the ranks of the uniformed military. And President Obama, feeling the heat, would undoubtedly love to know who leaked that sensitive report. This is Daniel Shore.